Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
I read recently that the last ever video recorder had gone into production, and I realised in that moment what it was to be finally getting on in age, to have lived long enough to see a piece of technology go from cutting edge to obsolete. Before the video recorder became a standard piece of equipment in every home, there were only two means by which we as children could watch the latest movie releases. The first was the cinema, which, being expensive, was a treat confined to communions, confirmations, and summer holidays. The second was Mr. Cunningham, a local man with a projector who visited Archbishop McQuaid National School once a month and made movies, actual movies, appear on the wall of our classroom. When I close my eyes, I can see him still, the man we called the film man. Tall, long coat, enormous Dennis Taylor glasses, a rolled up poster under his arm, and oh, the promise contained in that poster. From our desks, we would see him walking across the playground. Then the shout would go up. "He's coming, Mr. Barry." "Sig Sheas," the teacher would tell us. But that was impossible, for we looked forward to this man's visits in much the same way as we awaited the arrival of Santa Claus. In our heads, we counted his footsteps along the hallway to the classroom door before the knock would come. "Taras Jock," Mr. Barry would say. And Mr. Cunningham's head would peer around the door. We stood as one and greeted him in the sing-song manner we'd been taught to greet all visitors. "Fáilte raibh, Máister O'Quinnagán." And then the questions would start. "What's the poster, Mr. Cunningham? Is it the cat from outer space, is it?" "No," he'd reply. "It's not the cat from outer space." "Is it E.T.? Remember you said you'd see, could you get us E.T.?" "No, it's not E.T. either, because Steven Spielberg hasn't finished making it yet." And as it happens, I was talking to him about half an hour ago, and he said it won't be long now. But in the meantime, he'd unroll the poster with a magician's flourish. Ta-da! The Clash of the Titans. We handed over our 50p's and we daydreamed the week away until he returned with his 16mm projector. And the lights would go off and the movie would flicker to life. And we were suddenly transported to the pre-CGI world of winged horses and the Gorgon Medusa, who could turn a man to stone with just one look, and Ursula Andress as the lovely Aphrodite, and a fearsome sea creature called the Kraken, who was hell-bent on destroying Argos, the ancient kingdom rather than the shop. Sitting at our desks, we watched The Goonies, Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger, Herbie Goes Bananas, Flashdance, Bugsy Malone, The Cannonball Run, BMX Bandits, all these classic, probably awful, films from the early 1980s. And sitting at the back of the class working the projector was this hero of our Ballybrack childhood, who adored the movies and was so proud to be showing us these films, you'd almost swear he'd directed them himself. When Mr. Cunningham died in 2009, he left his son Keith an extensive collection of old reel-to-reel movies, as well as a small ledger in which he lovingly recorded the details of every movie he ever showed in every school in the 1980s. For Mr. Cunningham was the film man not only to us, but to thousands of other Dublin school kids. This ledger is like a local cultural doomsday book. Flicking through its pages, tracing my finger down the columns, I can see that on Monday, the 22nd of November, 1982, the children in the National School in Drimna watched Digby, the biggest dog in the world. And on Friday, the 16th of May, 1986, in Our Lady, Queen of the Apostles in Clonburris, they saw The Never-Ending Story. And on Thursday, the 17th of February, 1983, I can see that we, the pupils of Archbishop McQuaid National School, watched E.T. after Mr. Cunningham's great friend, Mr. Spielberg, finally got the finger out and finished making it. Recently, talking to Keith, I found out a little bit more than I previously knew about Mr. Cunningham. He was a former cinema manager who worked in more than a dozen picture houses, including the Star in Crumlin, the Stella in Rathmines, and the Gala in Ballyfermot, until, to his great heartbreak, he was made redundant in the early 1980s. At the time, cinema audiences were falling, and a lot of the old independent movie houses were closing down. But Mr. Cunningham came up with a simple idea. If people weren't going to go to the cinema anymore, he would take the cinema to them, which he did, coloring young lives like mine with the magic escapism of the movies.
Books. I love reading them, holding them, their weight, their smell. There's a Japanese word, tsundoku, for people who collect books just because they love the presence of them and because of the possibility that one day they'll open one and be transported to a different world. Archbishop Narcissus Marsh, who in 1707 opened Ireland's first public library, was a ferocious lover and collector of books. He sought, bought, and bequeathed an extraordinary collection of scholarly books, which to this day are held, conserved, and protected by Marsh's library's keepers and caretakers. They too love books, fiercely, and they execute their responsibilities with reverence and pride. Nowadays, anyone can go through the black iron gate behind St. Patrick's Cathedral, up the stone steps, and walk among dark oak bookshelves, still close stacked with Socrates, Aeschylus, Sterne, and Galileo, over 25,000 books on philosophy, theology, medicine and mathematics, witchcraft, poetry, music, and more. Some books can be requested for study within the library by scholars and researchers. More sit deep in shelves, with a metal bar across their spines, a drooping rope between them and their visitors. The lion's share of this precious collection is stored away from sight, a gargantuan process currently underway to share the contents of the books with future generations by capturing all 25,000 plus of them digitally. Many of them are enlivened by handwritten annotation, inkily threaded along margins, scribbled by centuries of readers. Jotted notes from Marsh himself, referencing and cross-referencing other books in his collection. Irascible editorial expletives from Jonathan Swift. There's a book raked with bullet holes from machine gun fire during the 1916 Rising. And James Joyce and Bram Stoker read at a wooden table that still sits in the center of the library. Readers of every discipline were locked in its small readers' cages to study through the night. Love letters were hidden among pages embellished with erudite and not so erudite 18th, 19th, and 20th century personal commentary. I've visited Marsh's many times, and when I walk between its shelves, inhaling the perfume of old paper and time, gaze upon rows of animal skin binding and gold leaf lettering, turn from a calligraphy practice desk towards readers' cages with Archbishop's mitres carved high above them, I think I can hear whispers of long-gone readers exchanging thoughts with those of writers before them, readers who may have been among the first people to trust the printed word to carry truth. Often I wish that I could enter that 300-year-long conversation, wish I could turn a page that 300 years of readers have turned and stow a question in a margin for 300 years of future readers to run their fingertips over. Last week, in my local library, I lifted a huge book from a shelf, a heavy hardback about global warming called The Last Chance for Change. Its heft was awkward, but this was weighty matter, and it felt somehow congruent that I needed both hands to carry it back to the table. I turned back the front cover, flivveled the pages, felt the breath and ploof as they landed, till the book fell open on a dark two-page image, the words, "Our Changing World," a silver whisper in the corner. It was dramatic, a vast image of the bright lights of Earth seen from space. Fathomless black oceans implanted with midnight blue landmasses, latticed with cobwebby white light trails. I brushed my fingertips over the surface of the paper, caressing the earth, the oceans, the continents. The smooth pages felt like satin. The fragrance of printed ink floated around me. Smell, sight, touch, imagination. It felt as if I'd never forget that image, or all that it implied about fragility and immensity. So completely did that moment, that encounter with that book, fill my senses. And then I thought of those protected volumes in Marsh's library, and I wondered, what exactly do books become when they aren't handled? How can those tactile, fragrant containers of thought fulfill the purpose for which they were made if they can no longer be touched, held, explored? Marsh's books, in their manifest vulnerability, have had to leave this conversation. They stimulated our ancestors' senses for hundreds of years. Now they must rest or die. We're too sensuous for them. Our heavy hands, warm breath, and quick heartbeat could cause them to perish entirely. Attended to by their small team of conservators, they're a little like this gorgeously preserved yacht here in the Asgard room. Marsh's books, now dry-docked vessels, can still transport us, but they'll do it in a different way. Whatever their rich contents that we'll now read on computer screens, just through the presence of these beautiful books in this noisy, changeful time, through their quietness and fragility, they'll tell the story to a world that is passing, of a world that has passed.
When I was six, my Limerick parents brought my brothers and me on the road trip of a lifetime, north and north and north, until we reached true north. We squeezed into the back seat of our orange Datsun, packed to the brim with a year's gear for a family of five, and burned up the highway north from Toronto, chiming in with our dad as he belted out, and not understanding one word of it. But Swiss Family Robinson, eat your heart out. We were on an awfully big adventure. Though it was the end of August, we had down feather winter jackets, hats, scarves, and boots at the ready. Mum made sure we weren't going to freeze. We piled these bulky layers on as we boarded the tiny Cessna plane at Nakina, North Ontario, and flew in over the Muskeg to Cat Lake, the remote First Nations reserve where my parents had taken up the job of running the local school. We were awaiting teepees, powwows, feather headdresses, moccasins, rain dances. The Cat Lake community must have found it odd seeing this strange family pile out of the plane in winter clothes, though it was boiling hot summer. We peeled off the layers and looked around for the teepees. Not one in sight, but lots of people just like us and much better attired for the weather. Our future friends. We joined them in school and thrived on a diet of moose meat, goose, and pickerel, mostly caught by Dad, a keen student of native hunting and fishing techniques. We drank carnation powdered milk from Hudson Bay Company, the only store on any isolated reserve. And we basked in nature's greatest show, the Aurora Borealis. The next year, we went to Ogokee Post, another reserve where my parents stayed for 7 years. Playing their unassuming part in the sensitive transition to on-reserve, native-run education earned my parents high praise from Chief Eli Munias, who said they were, quote, more Indian than the Indians themselves. Decades later, now working as a documentary maker, I hope to pay tribute to my parents' work with a film using Dad's Super 8 reels and medium format photographs from the reserve. But my dad was allergic to the notion of being recorded or interviewed. He was a man of few words, and the words he did speak were carefully chosen when it came to important topics like this. But that never stopped me trying. It was during his last days with us on Earth last year, as his body was falling apart in front of our very eyes, that in the middle of summoning every kilojoule of energy left at his disposal to haul his bones around the living room for a walk with his Zimmer frame, us pushing the furniture out of his way, clearing a path for him, he looked at me and said, "True North," as if this was the answer to everything, to all my incessant questions. True North. I felt I knew what he meant, all the questions he was efficiently addressing with these two words. No need to say anything else, no energy to waste. Stick to the essential. Okay. It was his 76th and last birthday. I really did want to make that film, but I was finding the thought of it overwhelming. And then he died, and I realized I simply had no choice. It had to be done, by hook or by crook, and it came down to me to do it. Just a fortnight after he had said those words to me, we were all back in the same Toronto living room, this time for my dear dad's funeral. It was happening at Corpus Christi Church. Up at home, I was looking at the clock and making sure I had the printout of the appreciation I wanted to read at the church. Tick. The only thing that could be done now was coffee. So I trudged through the snow down to Starbucks at the corner of our street. It was fairly busy, and there was a lively queue. I was thinking to myself, wow, these people have no idea what I'm going through right now. The fact that I'm actually en route to my dad's funeral, and inside, I'm in bits. It's not the kind of thing that belongs in idle coffee queue chit-chat, though I did offer a friendly smile here or there as best I could. When I got to paying for my coffees, I was getting a few for the family. A friendly, upbeat lady ahead of me in the queue, who had been talking about attending a furniture trade show in Toronto that morning, turned around and out of the blue, performed one of those random acts of kindness. Now, this sort of thing had never happened to me before or since, though I had heard tell of the phenomenon. She really did pick up the bill for all my coffees, as well as everybody else in the queue. "That's so kind," I said to her, still unable to give voice to my deep grief that my father's funeral was about to happen in the next half hour. I wished her all the very best in her trade fair. What else could I do? I asked, did she have a card so I could look up her furniture in case we ever needed any? She handed it to me with a smile. I was stunned into further silence when I read her company name. True North. Struck to my core by this, I knew she and the coffees had been sent by my dad. And I also knew what the name of his film had to be. True North. Pod Mulrooney's Irish-Canadian Adventures in Super 8. The universe had spoken. No, my dad had spoken through the universe. Or should I say, through that Starbucks coffee queue.
At a family gathering some years ago, my father-in-law, despite struggling with Alzheimer's, somehow managed to recite from memory a poem about memories, Shakespeare's Sonnet Number 30. When to the sessions of sweet silent thought, I summon up remembrance of things past. The irony of this achievement was compounded by the fact that despite having perfect recall of this poem, which interweaves metaphors from legal procedure and the courtroom, my father-in-law no longer had any memory that he had once been a lawyer. Although science would have us believe that memories are all a matter of the interaction of neurons at the hippocampal neocortical interface, I'm pretty sure that deep down, we all know it's not as simple as that. As we age, not only do we have difficulty in summoning up remembrance of things past, but very often the memories that sluggishly obey that summons turn out to be unreliable witnesses. What we think we recall accurately turns out either to have never happened or to have happened differently. To some extent, we all resemble Maurice Chevalier, whose recollection of the past is corrected gently but firmly by Hermione Gingold in Gigi. We met at 9. We met at 8. I was on time. No, you were late. Ah, yes, I remember it well. Her version may be more accurate than his, but that is not to say that it's any more real. Because when it comes to memories, the mind is its own place. At the end of my nephew's first communion ceremony recently, the priest invited everyone back to Belgrove School Hall for refreshments. And so, for the first time in almost 50 years, I found myself standing once again in the hall of the very same primary school that I had attended. As members of the parents' committee circulated with plates of home baking and pretended not to be noting mentally which mother's cakes were in demand, I surveyed my surroundings. Looking around, it seemed to me as if at some point over those 50 years, the school authorities had taken the bizarre and presumably costly decision to reduce the hall in length, breadth, and height. Because what had existed in my memory as a cavernous space where all 55 of us in Mr. Cleary's class assembled and sang Bawjean Eilemy in tuneless but impassioned disharmony had somehow shrunk to a structure of quite modest proportions. I made some comment to my sisters about how memory plays tricks on us, and we all nodded ruefully. However, it's not so much trickery as downright betrayal. Because last month, a radio item about Brian Friel sparked the realization that my last visit to Belgrove, rather than being 50 years ago, was only 30-odd years ago, sometime in the early 1980s, and the reason for my being there was to see Brian Friel's Philadelphia, Here I Come, performed by the local Temple Players, a theater group comprising teachers from Mount Temple School and assorted amateur drama types from Clontarf. The irony of my lapse of memory will not be lost on those familiar with the play, because amongst other things, Philadelphia deals with how memories can comfort and deceive. The night before Gar's departure for America, desperate to make some emotional connection with his aloof father, he reveals his most precious childhood memory to him. One May afternoon, he and his father fished from a blue boat on a lake, and with rain threatening, his father placed his coat protectively around Gar's shoulders and sang, "All Around My Hat," for no reason other than the fact that he was happy. But heartbreakingly, the father can remember neither the day, the boat, nor the song. Later, in conversation with Madge, his housekeeper, the father recalls his fondest memory, the day he walked the young Gar dressed in a wee sailor suit to school. Madge flatly contradicts him. A sailor suit? He never had a sailor suit. Memories, it seems, can be invented and erased. But by what process had my memory erased, even temporarily, a wonderful production of a wonderful play? A production that was memorable for many reasons. Memorable, firstly, because I won the raffle for the box of chocolates that was held during the interval. Memorable also because the role of Gar Private was played by an electrifyingly energetic Jerry Stembridge, resplendent in sequin jacket and bow tie. Memorable because, with just seconds to go before the curtain went up, four young men arrived together and took their seats in the row in front of mine. One of them was wearing a large cowboy hat that obscured my view of the stage. I endured it as long as I could and then leaned forward and asked if he wouldn't mind removing it. He apologized and immediately transferred it to his knee. During the interval, a friend said, "Do you see those lads over there? They're in some rock group. Everyone says they're going to be huge." I looked over and saw he was referring to the fellow with the fondness for frontier-style millinery and his three companions, who had all generously turned up to see their former teachers from Mount Temple do their thing on stage. For the past 3 weeks, I've been rummaging through old boxes in the attic in search of a theatre programme I think I can remember buying, and which will reassure me that I didn't just imagine that whole evening. So far, all I can find is a badly stained programme for yet another play I had forgotten I'd seen in Belgrove, Talca Row by Maura Laverty. I may not have the proof yet that I saw Philadelphia, but the mind is its own place, and what really matters is that in my own mind, I was there. I did win that raffle. And in my own mind, I will forever be the man who asked Bono to remove his hat.
That was a selection from Sunday Miscellany live at Culture Night over the past few years. The scripts were Mr. Cunningham by Paul Howard, Loving Books by Sharon Hogan, True North by Deirdre Mulrooney, and then it was The Mind is Its Own Place by Conall Hamill. The music this morning. First, the theme tune from E.T. by John Williams, played by the Carolyn Trio and arranged by Karen Durvin. Oft in the Stilly Night by Thomas Moore, sung by Simon Morgan, accompanied by Martin Tourish on accordion. Then, True North, composed and performed by Martin Tourish and Triona Marshall on accordion and harp respectively. And finally, Effervescence, composed and played by Shane Hennessy on guitar. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey and the producer is Sarah Binchy.
RTE Radio 1.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.